Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Greg Wells here, and thanks for joining me for another episode of the podcast. My new book, Powerhouse, launched last week. I am so excited, really proud, super thrilled with how everything has gone. And with the launch came a whole bunch of podcast interviews. And so I will be sharing the interviews that I've done about the book on other shows with all of you, because each podcast is so completely different because the interviewers from the other shows are asking completely wildly different questions about totally different topics. So each one's quite unique, but there's loads of amazing info and lots that I think that you can benefit from. So the episode that I'm sharing with you today is my interview with Mark White from the Health Hacks podcast, which is a really cool show that you should check out because there are loads of other amazing people on that show. And Mark does a great job of deconstructing how we can improve our health with actionable tactics that can make a big difference right away. So no further delays. Please enjoy my conversation all about my new book podcast with Mark White from the Health Hacks podcast.
Hello, this is Mark L. White with Health Hacks. And today I have Dr. Greg Wells with us. And I took a look at your website right before you coming onto the show. And I see that you're just somebody just really obsessed with human performance. And you know, the thing that stuck out is like some of this freaking Ironman stuff that you've been doing, biking across Africa. The first question that comes up is, what's the hardest thing you've done?
Other than parenting. So yeah, if you exclude having children, then probably the single hardest thing in terms of like an expedition I've ever done was in 2003, after I got my PhD from the University of Toronto in exercise science. Apparently no one hires you once you have a doctorate. I ended up going to Africa with my bike, sold everything, got rid of everything. So I had nothing around, and took 4 months and cycled from Cairo to Cape Town with the first ever Tour d'Afrique bicycle expedition. And it was 11,000 kilometers. I ended up doing about 8,000 K of it, various different injuries and crashes and stuff like that. But it was just an incredible expedition, without question, the hardest endurance thing by far I've ever done. Like nothing comes close. There was heat, there was cold, there was dysentery, there was like, you name it, like my, you know, like floods, like everything happened. So that was pretty brutal.
Just biking through the Sahara, I think, is tough.
Yeah, I flew into Khartoum, Sudan, and I joined the expedition in Khartoum because I had to defend my thesis, and I flew straight to Sudan, which in and of itself is an experience. Like, you know, it was in 2003, so that's when the Gulf War was starting, so there's lots of tension. So going through that airport was wild. And then I flew from Toronto, Canada, which was negative 30 Celsius, so like very, very, very cold, straight into Sudan. And our first day of riding was at plus 52, so like 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Like it was quite the physiological swing, but stunningly beautiful. If you can lift your head up off the handlebars, you can see some amazing stuff.
What inspires you to sell everything? You're a PhD, you have the world's your oyster, and you're like, okay, I'm going to sell everything and bike across Africa. It's not the first thing somebody graduating with a PhD would do. So what was your emphasis for that?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I love travel. I love cycling. Really loved it back then. I had been to Africa previously, so I knew what I was getting myself into. It just so happened that there was a time in my life where I knew that I had 4 or 5 months before I was going to have any chance of getting like a real job. So sort of, I graduated in February, knew that most academic positions would start the following September. So I had a window of time, and I could either sit around Toronto, you know, doing job interviews, or I could go and have a wild, crazy adventure. And, you know, I had $10,000 left in my student loans at the time. And it cost 11 grand to go do this expedition. So I, you know, found another $1,000 and gave it all to the lovely organizers and took off. So yeah, I don't know if there's any like specific reason other than just like, it was an adventure. It presented itself. I had an opportunity. I had nothing holding me down in Toronto, where I was living at the time. And I just went for it. And it changed so much about my life. I don't think I would have gotten the jobs that I've gotten. I don't think I would have had the speaking career that I've had. Like that was without question, like the hardest thing, but also opened up so many opportunities, which is bizarre. And I never would have known about any of them when I left.
So what was the biggest door that it opened for you?
So when I got back from Africa and I was back in Toronto and I started to do sort of a job search-ish, because you hypothetically need to do that, a lot of the traditional, you know, academic positions were full. I wasn't really getting any traction. And I heard about a position at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, which is a top research institution in the world. And although I'd done all of my research up to that point in Olympic sport and all of my experience was as a physiologist with Olympic athletes, they were launching an exercise lab for children with respiratory disease, which just happened to be what I did my research on, was on respiratory lung function, breath work. I went in and I met the team, and all they wanted to talk about was the Africa trip. So I think they asked me two questions about my thesis, and the rest of it was like, so what was cycling through Africa like? And we had this great chat and ended up bonding with everyone over the fact that I was in Africa riding my bike. And then a couple of weeks later, I was you know, building a research program at the Hospital for Sick Children in Exercise Medicine.
That's amazing. And you talked about breath work. Are we talking about breath work in terms of like Wim Hof and like the very focused breath work?
So now we all know, and like, I think breath work sort of having its moment right now. And I think it's valid. It works. And if you breathe differently, it changes your physiology. And back when I did my PhD, what I was looking at was whether or not we could train ourselves specifically to breathe less. And the reason why is because I was a competitive swimmer and I was coaching swimming at the time and working as a physiologist for Olympic level athletes. And what I wanted to do was make sure that technique drove the stroke, not breathing. So if you can think about swimming, if you're out of breath, you rush to the next breath, right? Your stroke shortens so you can get to the next breath. Or in rowing, if you're hyperventilating and your breathing is out of control because you have too much lactic acid pumping through your system, your stroke shortens and become inefficient. So I was trying to figure out, how do we train away the urge to breathe? So we were doing that at the time, doing breath holds during exercise. So you allow your breathing to stop. You hold your breath as you're exercising and your CO2 levels go up and your oxygen levels go down, and you expose yourself to that over and over and over again. And you desensitize yourself to carbon dioxide. And the other thing we did was respiratory muscle training. So we actually had this little device that you put in your mouth. It's called a power breathe. And it puts resistance, just like lifting weights, for your lungs and for your rib cage muscles and your diaphragm, so that we could strengthen the muscles of breathing. And we experimented with how that worked as well. We found that both of those things are possible. You can train away your urge to breathe, and you can also strengthen specifically your respiratory muscles to become more efficient at your sport.
So a lot of it's really, I think, being mindful, because I know like a little bit about breath work when I'm running or something, and it's just sometimes we don't realize our breath. Like and I agree with you, it's super important, but nobody discusses that.
And you latched onto something really interesting. Like when you're out for a run, if you don't think about your breathing at all, your breathing will happen automatically. So when we're asleep, you have a certain level of breathing. That's just the natural drive to breathe. It's from the brain stem, and make sure that you breathe throughout your life. Stop breathing, you die. So that's your basic base level of drive to breathe. We then have the wakefulness drive. As soon as you wake up, those neurons in your brain are a little bit more excited, and so you breathe a little bit more. If you move your limbs, then there's nervous system feedback to the brain saying that we're moving, we're probably going to need to breathe harder. So you breathe a little bit harder. And then if you exercise at a higher intensity and you produce acids or potassium in your muscles, there are nerves that send signals to the brain that we breathe harder so that we can get rid of all of those waste products. There's all sorts of things that play into our control of breathing. The interesting thing is those are all physiological. They're all unconscious. They happen naturally without you thinking about them. You can also change your breathing by consciously thinking about it. So if we're running, what we want to try to do is practice something called entrainment, where your breathing is in rhythm with your movement. That's true for running, cycling, rowing, and swimming, anything that's rhythmic and repetitive. And you've probably felt that when you're in a really relaxed breathing pattern and you're running and you sort of forget about it, you enter a flow state. That's beautiful. In tennis, you can go and do something completely different, which is exhale in time with the power movement. So when a tennis player exhales or even maybe yells when they hit the ball, that's leveraging the power of breathing to increase the nervous system power, so you become more explosive and more powerful. if you want to relax, we do the opposite, sort of like the birthday candle breath, where you do that long exhale, right? And that's what helps us to calm down. So there's a number of different ways we can use breath work to adjust our physiology to do what we want to do a little bit better.
So right now you work with athletes, you work with high performers, and you teach them more on the breath work side, I assume, but what other hacks besides breath work are most helpful, or something that would be of interest to somebody, like just an easy hack that we should all be doing?
Right. So I think the easiest thing, I'll just mention breath, a couple, easy ideas around breath work is, first of all, if you're tired, if you're bored, if you're just you need to get psyched up, mm-hmm. you can actually use your breathing to spark the energy inside of your brain. So if you do these hard exhales, right? Like think about an athlete right before they're about to compete, what are they doing? They're like, right? Like this hard exhales wakes you up. And so you can do that before a speech. You can do that before a meeting. You can do that before a workout. You can do that before a lift within a workout, right? Just to spark your energy and bring you up. However, the vast majority of us these days are challenged with stress, anxiety, fear, right? Like there's a significant level of tension in many of our lives at the moment, in which case we need to do the opposite. And that is those long, slow exhales, right? Like just the birthday candle breath, the breath of calm, the box breathing that Special Forces soldiers practice, which is just 4 seconds in, 4 seconds hold, 4 seconds out, 4 seconds hold, right? So when we relax our breathing consciously, it actually calms the stress region of the brain down. So it's those hard exhales to psych up, and the long, slow, relaxing exhales to calm down. And that's something that any of us can do any day, just to instantaneously improve our performance. But the other real benefit of that is it also dramatically improves our mental health, which is a huge factor for so many of us these days.
How does it do that?
Well, one of the interesting things is that if we sort of think about the significant challenges that many of us are faced with right now, and I'm talking about mild to moderate mental health issues, nothing clinical like schizophrenia or personality disorders or anything like that. We're just talking about mild to moderate anxiety and depression. We think about that tension that many of us experience, or the anxiety or fear that many of us might experience, especially if you look at news headlines these days or whatever happens to be uncomfortable to think about or to experience. We can use our breath to help us to get centered, help us to bring our attention back into the present moment. That's the practice of mindfulness. You just bring your attention into the present moment. You need an anchor to do that. Often the breath will do that beautifully. So you just simply think about what the feeling of bringing air into your body is through the nostrils, into your lungs, and then what it feels like to exhale. Maybe you count your breaths as well. And when we bring our attention back into the present moment and we practice that mindfulness and we slow down our breathing and we breathe fully and completely, that can help to alleviate many of the experiences, the physical experiences associated with some of those mental health challenges, and helps us to feel a little bit better in the moment.
Well, so another thing that's really big right now is sleep. And I think there's been so much research on getting enough sleep. I actually have an Oura ring. I track my sleep. I'm lucky if I get more than 6 hours, but people say I need 8 hours or 7 hours. I don't know if that's a myth that we need 8 hours and if 6 hours is my default mode, but I'd love to hear your opinion on sleep and what some of the best sleep hacks are.
Got it. So I think sleep is foundational for us. It's the fundamental space for all of our health and well-being. Sleep is related to our lifespan, certainly related to our health span as well. The research is pretty clear that people who sleep on average 7 to 8 hours a night have the lowest risk for all-cause mortality. Any less than 6 hours, your risk of all-cause mortality starts to go up. So you're on that threshold, but you're probably still okay. Interestingly enough, any more than 9 hours consistently is also associated with an increased risk for all-cause mortality. But I think that less than 6 hours causes problems, whereas more than 9 hours is symptomatic. Like if you're sick, you sleep a lot, for example. If you want to improve your sleep, a few simple, easy hacks that you can do. Number one thing is set a bedtime alarm instead of a morning alarm. When we're consistent with the time that we go to sleep, body learns when to produce and release melatonin, which is awesome for us because it's a natural way for us to fall asleep, melatonin being the hormone that regulates our sleep-wake cycles. Second thing that you can do is make sure that your bedroom is pitch black. The darker your bedroom is, the better, because even a little bit of light going through the eyelid, if your eyes are closed, will decrease the amount of melatonin that is released, making it easier for you to wake up and have that interrupted sleep. So the pitch black, the sleep cave kind of idea is what we're looking for. And then the third idea, and then I'll pause, is around defending your last hour, really making sure that that last hour before you fall asleep is protected. So you're doing things like taking a hot bath, or maybe reading a fiction book, or doing some meditation, or talking to loved ones, but we're not watching the news. We're not doom scrolling through social. You know what I mean? Like, so we're deactivating the brain. We're calming our bodies down. And when we do that, ultimately that hopefully will help us to sleep a little bit better. And you can actually monitor that. You wearing a Neura Ring, Fitbits work, Apple Watch works. We've got an app that we've developed that enables us to look at deep sleep, REM sleep, light sleep. It's called Vivio. If anyone wants to check that out, it's free to try. So you can check that out for a while. Vivio? Yeah. So I think it's big. Vivio, V-I-I-V-I-O is the app.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never heard that before, defending the last hour, but I like that. I think my sleep problem started the day I got my iPhone in 2008.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to like get into that habit of turning the phone off right before you go to sleep. But yeah, that's really interesting. So we talked about sleep. We talked about breath work. So right now, what you do, I know you speak, you write books. You also work with athletes, Olympic athletes or athletes from all levels.
Yeah, I tend to work with sort of top 20 in the world ish. And my job is to take them from that level and put them on the podium. Done a lot of work with military operatives, expedition athletes that try to run across deserts. We have a research program at SickKids that also looks at exercise for kids with cancer and cystic fibrosis and heart conditions as well. So I work at the extremes, either with people who are trying to win medals at the Olympics or run very large companies, or if you're really, really sick, you've got cancer, cystic fibrosis, other big challenges. What I try to do is learn from the extremes.
That's interesting.
Take all of that information, share that in books or in podcasts like this one to help all of us. So even though we're learning from the Olympics, the practices apply to everybody.
If you're going to look at your top 20 performers and say, like, these are these commonalities that they have that, you know, like the general public doesn't have, or the general public doesn't adopt, what would you say are the top three things that you see all of them have in common?
Yeah, whether it's sports, business, music, drama, the consistencies amongst the high performers are very evident once you start having those conversations. It's funny, you can sit down at dinner, start talking to someone, and immediately know roughly where they are in the world. At their level. Yeah, it's fascinating. And the biggest shift that I noticed between sort of like, let's say top 100 in the world and top 10 in the world in any discipline is that the top 10 in the world have an incredible sense of curiosity. They're the first ones to ask questions. They're the first ones to look for more information. They will take your entire dinner with them and ask you questions, where lower on the scale, it doesn't happen quite the same. And so that's probably the first big one, is a really incredible sense of curiosity.
I was going to say that's interesting because I never would have thought about it. But now that you bring that up, I see that a lot with business, like people who run businesses. That's very interesting, actually.
Yeah. And it's just this openness, non-judgmental, and assuming that they can learn, right? That's them. They don't know it all. And if you think about it, like Serena Williams has a tennis coach, right? Like, she's number one in the world by far, but she's constantly looking for someone to give her feedback on how to get better. And that's an interesting characteristic that they have. Another really interesting sort of counterintuitive characteristic is simplicity. You'd think that they'd have all of these complicated training programs or technology hacks that they're using. And so often when you get into the daily training environment and you spend time with them, you realize that they're just eating really healthy food really consistently. They're not taking that many supplements, if any. Their training is pretty basic, but absolutely relentlessly consistent. They practice their basic skills, the simple skills, over and over and over again. The degree of simplicity, but however, consistency is absolutely shocking when you first get in there and take a look at what they're up to.
I think it's like Malcolm Gladwell writes about like 10,000 hours to master something. And so what you're saying is like, if you just focus on just doing it repetitive over and over again, the simple stuff, don't take days off. That's what the high performers all do.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I worked in golf for many years. And what we used to say is quality ball contacts, right? Like how many quality ball contacts can you get in? Not just scrape and hit, but fully prepared, deliberate practice, golf, with golf, intention.
Sorry? I was going to say golf is all consistency.
It's all consistency. I actually think golf's about 20,000 hours. It's a little bit more than 10,000. Yeah. Some other sports are a little bit less. Music is in and around, you know, that 10 to 20,000 hour zone, which is actually achievable. It's kind of like 20 to 30 hours over a 10 year period to get to that level of excellence. But yeah, no, it's the simplicity and the consistency. Just show up, be deliberate, be focused, eliminate the distractions, do your very, very best. You will fail a ton. The more you fail, the faster you will progress. That research is quite clear as well. The more failure experiences that you have, the faster your learning will be. And that's one of the ways to accelerate becoming good at anything it is that you want to do.
I love that. I wrote that down. Show up, be deliberate, be focused, do your best.
That's it. And if you make it there, that's fantastic. And if you don't, you've learned, you've gotten better, you've improved, you've developed your mindset, your health set, your soul set, like all of these different factors come along for the ride. Not all of us are going to be number one in the world, but we can all just get better at whatever it is that we care about the most, whatever we're interested in, and whatever we're passionate about.
So when you talk about mindset, I'm sure there's a commonality of mindset with high performers, but what would you say is the number one trait that sticks out talking about mindset? Is it resilience? Is it growth?
I'll break it into training and competition.
Okay.
In training, it's positivity. If you can be positive, if you can be encouraging, if you can learn, if you have that growth mindset in and around the training environment, which is so hard, right? That's when you're up at 5 a.m. in February and it's snowing and you got to go to the gym and you don't want to go because you're tired. But if you're the one that's at the gym and you're happy and you're encouraging the people around you, you are generally going to be one of the ones that does the best most consistently. Once you get to the competition, the Olympics, whatever the performance is, and this is true for music and drama and business as well, the number one thing that I think makes the biggest difference once you're actually there is your ability to eliminate distractions and to focus. So you've got media, parents, opposing players, or the crowd, all of which can be a distraction. And if you can eliminate all of those distractions and focus on your performance, that gives you the best chance in the competition environment itself.
Let's do a deep dive on focus and eliminating distractions. And if you can just let me in on like 3 to 5 things you would advise your clients on how to do that.
Number one thing right now, in an era of constant unrelenting distraction due to these devices that we have around us all the time, number one thing is to turn off all the audio notifications on all of your devices at all times.
I'm taking notes because this is my biggest challenge, by the way.
Your attention is the currency of this era. So you control where your attention goes. The only way to make that happen is to make sure that you're not getting pinged all the time to check your phone, which is what it's designed to do. Like, it's designed to capture and hold your attention. They want you on the device. They want you on the social media apps because that's how they monetize your eyeballs, right?
The best apps are monetized to get your eyeballs on the apps to keep you there.
Exactly. So you want to protect your attention, just like you defend your last hour before sleep.
I like
defending your attention during the day is the single most important thing that high performers can do to ensure that your energy goes where you want it to go. So if you're in the gym, for example, and you want to have a great workout, turning off all the audio notifications to make sure that you don't get interrupted during your workout is really, really important. I'm not saying don't answer your emails, don't get back to your clients, any of that stuff, right?
Or just don't bring your phone to your workout.
Which is another major thing. Like, I've actually moved everything onto my, like, my workout tracking is on my watch. So I don't bring my phone, because then I can't access any of the other distracting apps that I have on it. The second big thing I would encourage people to think about is when during the day you feel usually the most energized. So if you are a morning person and you feel like you are clear, sharp, focused easily in the morning, that is the most important time for you to defend your attention and not get distracted, so that you can do your most important work in a completely undistracted environment. Robin Sharma calls it the tight bubbles of total focus. So defending that time when you are naturally at your best is critical. So for me, that's 7 to 10 a.m. I am awesome during those hours.
Robin Sharma, the guy who wrote The Monk.
Yeah, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, that author has a concept.
I just bought that book about an hour ago. So it's funny.
You're kidding. Oh, that's so funny. I spoke at his Titan Summit a few times. He's got some really great tips for people if you want to dig into his content.
Yeah, no, I'm excited about learning more there. So basically knowing when you're the most energized, and there's apps, like I have an app called Sleep Reset that actually it sat there and said, okay, your energy time after you do your sleep log for a few weeks, it'll tell you your energy time is from 10:34 a.m. to 12 something, and then
perfect,
energy's down, and then you have another big focus late in the afternoon. And so I think, and I've known, just knowing my body, I know that that's accurate, but I think knowing that and cramming everything in there, because you can get more stuff done in those 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours, than you can try to slog through an 8 hour, 12 hour day.
And I think the 8 hour, 12 hour slog is such a relic of 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? When you had to sit on the assembly line for 8 to 12 hours or longer and just do something mindless and repetitive. As we all move into an era where creativity, innovation, problem solving is the currency of the future, especially with artificial intelligence coming online so rapidly, we have to be thinking differently about how we approach our days.
Let's talk about that, because I've been fascinated by AI. I've been going down the AI rabbit hole. I've read articles that said 80% of today's jobs are going to be eliminated. First of all, I think if 80% of the jobs are eliminated, we have bigger problems, but I don't think that's true. I think we just haven't figured out how to harness AI, but I'd like your opinion on that.
I would agree with that. I mean, just look iteratively throughout history, jobs get replaced. The tractor eliminated many jobs in agriculture. And the personal computer eliminated many jobs that existed before. I think artificial intelligence absolutely will eliminate many, many jobs. Doesn't mean that there's going to be a decrease in the total number of jobs. It just means that there's going to be a shift in the types of jobs that we are doing. I say that as someone who, I do research in digital magnetic resonance imaging, for example, and we know that computers and artificial intelligence analyze x-rays, CAT scans, and MRIs a lot faster than humans do, with a lot fewer errors. And so radiology will be something that will be very different in the future. It will be, a radiologist plus AI rather than just the radiologist in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you come to radiology, you'll need that, but you'll still need a radiologist to interpret what the AI is saying.
Something like that, right? In some way, shape, or form, at least for the next 5 to 7 years, I would submit that it's probably going to be the human plus AI that is able to do a better job than the human alone or the AI by themselves. So it's just another tool.
In 30 years, are you going to have AI alone and no need for humans?
Yes, in many areas, we absolutely will. I mean, there's no question that that's the direction that it is going for certain fields. I think that it will absolutely, a technology, let's just bundle it as technology. In 30 years, will technology render the vast majority of jobs that exist today irrelevant? I think that it probably will. I have two children, 8 and 12, right? So will their jobs that they're going to hold in 15 years after they're done college exist today? Probably not. So how do you equip them for that? You need to be able to learn very, very quickly. You need to have an incredible growth mindset. You need to practice creativity. You need to practice problem solving. You need to practice all of those core skills that enable you to thrive in a rapidly changing environment.
Repeat those back, because I'm taking a lot of notes here because I find this stuff
great. So that's awesome.
You said growth mindset, creativity, right? Was the other one?
Yeah, sure. So if we think of it in terms of brainwave states, we have beta brainwave mode, which is just execute and get stuff done. That's repetitive tasks. That's your email to-do list. That is absolutely going to be automated for sure. That's the first thing to go. The next level of brainwave function is alpha brainwave states. That's strategic thinking and learning. So we want to be practicing our ability to learn. That's that growth mindset, that openness, that curiosity that we spoke about earlier. Mm-hmm. The ability to think strategically, I think, is also something that is going to be very human for a significant period of time. That's alpha brainwave states. If you slow down your brain activation just a little bit further, we enter into theta brainwave states. Theta brainwave states are when we're creative, we problem solve, and we innovate. That is absolutely going to be human for a very long period of time.
In problem solving, yep.
Yeah. So, and then if you slow down even further, you're in delta mode, you just fall asleep. We also talked about that earlier. So
AI doesn't have to worry about.
AI does not have to sleep. So it will not be a factor for that.
And you can actually see these brain waves. Like when you hook up a machine to a brain, you can see the brain waves. And you know, I actually read something where pretty soon, and we may already be there, AI can actually read your brain waves and show an image of what you're thinking.
We're getting close to that. There's been a few experiments that have been done where words can be created simply through mapping the brain and noticing what regions of the brain are active, and the word will pop up on the screen. Some images, possibly relatively soon. I mean, that experimentation is ongoing. There's definitely going to be the ability to do that. I don't think it's there at all right now, but certainly it will definitely go in that direction.
Yeah, and then I think with AI, it's freaking fascinating, but I think we're going to get to a point with, we're going to have a lot of societal issues because you have 8 billion people. You don't have enough jobs to keep them purposeful. You're going to have some people embracing AI to become this higher level of human performance. But like socially, like how is this going to cope? Because this, I think AI is the biggest, is as big, if not bigger than the internet, or it will be.
Right. I'm stepping out of Greg, the physiologist, who's a practiced researcher and speaks with experience and knowledge about stuff, and into Greg, the person who's fascinated by technology and is trying to use technology to make sure that I'm not irrelevant as an author, as a speaker. I know that AI is going to completely revolutionize the way that I write my next book. There's no question about that, but I need to know that because I'm going to be able to write the book a lot faster if I use AI versus if I don't. Having said all of that, will this cause society level challenges? Absolutely. I think that what we're experiencing right now is very much just like we had a transition from agriculture to industry. And that took 20 to 30 years, about 100 years ago. Right now, we're going from industry to technology. And that transition is going to be just as disruptive and probably much more disruptive than the shift from agriculture to industry. That will change jobs, that will change societies. I want to be on the cutting edge of that to make sure that I'm able to defend my ability to earn a living. But definitely it's going to cause some significant challenges, especially with the way the educational system is set up right now, where we're not necessarily moving quickly to enable students to learn the skills that they need to learn to be competitive in a brand new world of tech versus industry.
It's funny because my son, he goes to university, and says, "Dad, I can write essays and get A's on essays using AI."
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm asking him, is that cheating? And he's like, no, it's not, because I'm not copying it from a human. I'm just using it to help with my thoughts, and they haven't banned me from this. And I'm, you know, so like part of me is thinking this is a great tool. Part of me is he actually learning anything? Because we develop our critical thinking skills by doing the neural networks that we're now giving to AI. So, and I know we've got off base on high performers. And part of me is thinking, how is AI going to change high performance? Are you going to be able to take what you do, implement AI, give it to these top 20 performers in the world, whether it's all this, and now you have super tennis players or you have super executives because they've used AI?
Yes, to all of the above, I think. It's funny when you say that your son's using AI to do well in school. I still think that right now you can't trust it. And you have to have a human who's knowledgeable to be able to use it effectively. So for example, I used ChatGPT the other day and I said, who is Dr. Greg Wells? I asked it like, who am I? And it was remarkably accurate. Said I was a physiologist and well, I've written 3 books. I've actually written 5, but wrote the first one is The Ripple Effect. Great. The second one is Rest, Focus, Recharge. Yes, correct. And the third one was some soft porn book, which clearly I didn't write. I wish I had, because I'm sure it sold way more copies than any of my books did. Right? So I was like, delete. So clearly you still need someone to be able to say, look, this is probably true. That's not bad. This is wrong. And right now, because it just scrapes the internet and feeds it to you in a language model that you can understand, there's a high likelihood that something in what you have used AI to generate will be incorrect. So humans are absolutely important right now. And you cannot just trust it to feed things out. However, you can speed up what you do if you use it for what it's capable of doing.
I mean, ultimately AI is like when you get down to it, it's a prediction machine.
Correct.
That's all it is, okay, we're predicting that this is going to be right. And you're clicking thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah.
And right now it makes mistakes because the prediction machine is not perfect. But what happens when we get to a point where, you know, these things are run really, really well because it grows, grows at Moore's law, you know, where in 18 months from now, it's going to be twice as good. And 36 mm-hmm. months from now, 4 times as good.
As an author, there's no way that I can compete in the future unless I have a deep understanding of how to use artificial intelligence to gather information,
please
write quickly, efficiently, and effectively.
You still
and produce,
but I don't know, because I'm thinking like you, because you are obviously a genius with all these experiences. Now you have to put it in a book form that's compelling that people are going to want to read. But you put the information in, and then you just say, ChatGPT, here's the information. This is what I want to do. Make this compelling. And then you read it and you say, make it more compelling. I like this. Right. So you're basically, and I think in the past you may have used an editor or a ghostwriter or somebody to have helped you do it. You don't need to hire that person right now. ChatGPT is your ghostwriter, but the thoughts come from you. They don't come from ChatGPT. So it's still like, it's still very
relevant. There are people that are going to try to do it and use it as a ghostwriter. Those books will be prolific and not very good.
I would not want to.
Vanilla-ish. But yeah. However, if you use, what I'm probably going to do is use ChatGPT as my first level of editing. Mm-hmm. So instead of scanning it for grammar and punctuation and sentence structure, which I have to do because I'm good at ideas, but not at details, that will probably speed up the process of my passes on the first 2 rounds of the book before it goes off to my real editor who has thinking around what people might actually want to read.
Yeah, the other day I was actually writing a long email to a client. I wrote the email, but before I sent it, I took the email, cut it, put it into ChatGPT, said, read this email and write a more compelling version of it. And it wrote an amazing freaking email that I sent to the client, and it got a good response. And it was the first time I've ever done that. But like now I'm thinking to myself, every time I send out an email, I'll probably get in the habit of doing that. So it's using tools, but we're still doing our life. I mean, you know,
exactly.
You know, we're not going to have the 40-hour work week. Maybe we have a 5-hour work week and there's more free time and life's better and we're heading down this utopia state.
Which is what the promise was back when I was young. And I remember hearing about this thing called the personal computer. The idea was that the personal computer was going to save us all sorts of time. And then we would have all this free time to do whatever we want. And what ended up happening is it just enabled us to work do a lot more in the same amount of time. And I actually think that's just what all of these tools will do as well. What I'm really hopeful of, honestly, when it comes to like this vision of the future, is that we shift towards a type of future where human potential is unlimited, and that these tools enable us to spend more time on what we love, whether that's music, drama, sports, business, arts, whatever it is, and do what we love to do at a higher level more easily. If it unlocks human potential, then I think it's fantastic. If it just pushes us down the rabbit hole of more quantity, but not, you know, more quality in terms of our output as humans, then I think it's problematic. And I would be very disappointed in that future if that's actually the case for my kids.
I think with your platform and with what you've done writing books, and I think you're going to have a lot of influence on the future. And I really envy, like, just listening to your story. And we didn't even get into everything else that you've done. But if people want to learn more, your website is just drgregwells.com, drgregwells.com.
That's the best place to find me at drgregwells.com. All my social media are there. The books are there. The speaking's there. Our app link is there too. So everyone's welcome to check that out, and would welcome any conversations. DM me.
And that app is Vivio, right?
Yeah, the app is Vivio. It's Latin for life. So it's V-I-I-V-I-O. We'd love for people to check that out as well.
And pretty soon we're going to find your ChatGPT API on how to perform at the highest levels.
Well, we're going to embed AI into Vivio shortly. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, they said that if you're a company and you're not already thinking about how to incorporate ChatGPT or AI into your business processes, you're already losing.
Yeah, it's. I'm hoping that it just enables people to ask questions and get better personalized answers more quickly, but from a trusted web, right? Not just scraping the internet randomly, but from a trusted web of people that are true experts.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I really, this was wonderful, and I really appreciate it.
Mark, thank you so much for introducing me to your audience. And I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to share a few ideas with people. And yeah, I had so much fun. It was really great.
Great. I'm going to get, which book should I start with?
Get Powerhouse, because that's a new one. It's out April 4th. So the new book is Powerhouse. And if you wanted to check out the basics, that's The Ripple Effect, which is all about sleep, nutrition, exercise, and mindset.
Okay. And what's Powerhouse about?
Powerhouse is about breath work, movement, energy, and thriving. So it's breathe, move, energize, thrive is the framework. And it's all about helping us to overcome burnout, overwhelm, fatigue, and have more energy for all of the things we care about the most in our lives.
Excellent. I'm going to get those. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Mark, thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care.